Today on Against the Grain, whether the U.S. is in or out of the Paris Climate Accord, woefully little has been done to stop global warming. My guest today argues that the most serious effects from climate change won't only be ecological, but will also be political. I'm Sasha Lilly. Jeff Mann will join me to talk about what possible political orders may take hold from the disruptions caused by heating planet. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. While the dangers of climate change have been known for many decades, almost nothing has been done to limit greenhouse gas emissions. And while the perils from global warming will only increase in the future, the climate crisis is here already. Given that, Jeff Mann and his co-author Joel Wainwright argue that we need to be asking ourselves about the possible political futures we face in a warming world, both authoritarian and potentially egalitarian. In their much-anticipated book, Climate Leviathan, A Political Theory of Our Planetary Future, Wainwright and Mann posit that various paths are possible, although one route is most likely. Jeff, let me begin by asking you why we're in the situation we find ourselves, where those in power did almost nothing to stop global warming.
We're definitely at a point, as you say, where we have done virtually nothing. In fact, one might even argue we've done worse than nothing because we didn't even slow down, really. We just talked about slowing down a lot. We gathered together and patted each other on the back for talking about slowing down several times. But for the most part, we have continued on business as usual, as they say. And I think that a full and probably, you know, justifiable explanation of how we got there would be so expansive as to be, you know, halfway between overwhelming and trivial insofar as it tried to tie everything in. In the book, Joel and I, and in other books that we really admire, like, for example, Andreas Malm's Fossil Capital, he ties Malm, and Joel and I would agree on this front, he ties the development of the problem, you know, to the emergence of a fossil fuel-based capitalism and its rapid acceleration and expansion over time across the globe. And I think that even if one need not go back to the 1840s and 50s and think of these people as secretly, you know, warming the globe and they knew it and they had a conspiracy to keep it from us all. Of course, that's not true. We can still nonetheless associate the massive destruction associated with climate change. As you say, going on now, has gone on in the past, and will, of course, be worse in the future. We can associate that very much with an organization of economic life driven by the expansive demands of capitalism, demands that have, you know, pushed aside concerns for human rights, for ecological justice, and for, I think, reasonable expectations of a democratic polity entirely over time.
Well, just in terms of thinking about capitalism itself, there were people who have, in effect, looked the other way while global warming has accelerated, who you would imagine would stand to lose with the kind of havoc that's being wreaked on the planet through climate change. I'm talking here about the capitalist class that at some point, and maybe that point has already arrived in different sectors, won't this bite into their profits? And how does it affect our understanding of their inaction?
Right. That is a fascinating question. I'm not sure that I have any, you know, better insight into that than all the other people who have been struggling, like you, to figure out the answer to that question. It does seem like the basic tenets of sort of liberal self-interest would suggest that it would have been smart to rethink this a while back. And that clearly didn't happen. I think, you know, we could turn to the sort of standard explanations. And by standard, I don't mean, you know, untrue by any means. You know, the sort of institutional inertia. There is definitely built into many social formations a kind of myopia and expectation that that tomorrow will be like today. And in fact, I think assuming that relationship, some sort of consistency over time, is pretty fundamental to most, not just institutions, but social relationships. We know we organize ourselves around a view of things staying reasonably closely, similarly over time. So there's those sort of standard explanations of the kind of why we didn't do anything. But I also think that there are other ways in which the institutional tweaks, the increasing interdigitation or, you know, complex links that are, have been built up between capitalism, capitalists, and the modern capitalist state have made it possible to not only ignore but even exacerbate the forces driving climate change, because as of yet, those haven't actually affected the bottom line, as you might say, or profit rates. They have actually arguably, you know, improved the situation, especially of the capitalists at the top. And so insofar as we're trying to explain their lack of action, we could also turn to a relatively straightforward explanation on the flip side and say, actually, they've benefited enormously from that inaction, and persistent resistance to inaction moving forward into the future, that has taught them that pays very well. So that, on the other hand, is not very surprising. Again, this is not a comprehensive explanation by any means, but I think there are many, many, many forces kind of over-determining what we might think of as sort of heels dug in resistance.
Well, in your book, you argue that the most serious effects from climate change won't only be ecological, but also political, and that climate change will fundamentally reshape the societies that we live in, and that is the circumstances of climate change. And you imagine a number of different possible paths along which societies might go. And some of them are paths where the future will be determined from above and some from below. And we'll talk about the from below ones later in the program. But I wonder if you could lay out the possible paths that you see the societies following, obviously bearing in mind that we're talking about very uneven and different societies around the world.
Joel and I are trying to say exactly as you've framed it there, that to frame it in the way that I'm just about to isn't to say that we're the only ones who've realized that this has political implications. But it is the case that I think sometimes when we think about the impacts of climate change, we do understandably have a tendency to think explicitly about what we might think of as the environmental changes that are afoot. You know, say a lack of drinking water in particular places in the world, or the melting of the ice caps and associated sea level rise. We tend to think of climate change as playing out in the natural world, let's say. But as you said, Joel and I focus the book on the sort of unspoken or reasonably less often spoken flip side of that, which is, of course, that politics won't stay the same. And there'll be many, many challenges to our to the political organization of societies that will be driven by the kinds of environmental shifts that we're talking about. For example, if we think of a sea level rise that makes huge parts of the coastal Asia uninhabitable because they are underwater, then we're going to see massive movements of people that put pressures on food supplies and other societies, the places that they move, the so-called problem of the climate refugee. That's just sort of one of the more glaring versions of the ways that these problems will put pressure on our political institutions. And so the goal of the book is to think about, you know, the world is going to change. That seems to us to be incontrovertible. So the question is, therefore, trying to anticipate what some of the trajectories of change might look like depending upon the relationship of forces in certain parts of the world, or perhaps even at a global scale as we move forward. We lay it out in a kind of admittedly oversimplistic heuristic table, which has irritated several readers, and it's irritated us at times too, where we basically map out four very general ideal types of kind of the movement of politics and environment in the future. And we call them, as you've hinted at, climate Leviathan, climate Behemoth, climate Mao, and climate X. And climate Leviathan, the title of the book, is the one that we expect to be most likely, and that is basically an order, either at the planetary or at the international level, that tries to maintain, to the extent that it's possible, a kind of liberal capitalist, perhaps less and less liberal, capitalist frame under the guise of very clear sovereign powers, either at the national or international scale. And we expect that to take a very heavy-handed form, precisely because the work that will be required to keep capitalism possible and to keep elites in power, to keep the dominating dominating, that will require extraordinary exercises of sovereign power to maintain that order. And but though we do think that is the most likely direction in which we're headed, and our goal is to think about how we might resist that in a just way.
What do you mean by sovereign power? And could you paint a more detailed picture of how what you're talking about, climate Leviathan, how that would differ from what we currently have as a world order?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question request, let's say. So effectively, Joel and I have been, you know, like a lot of us, you too, I'm sure, have been, you know, watching the unfolding of global climate politics over the last couple of decades, especially over the last decade, and, you know, the various meetings of the Conference of the Parties, and the most publicity, of course, being accorded to the Copenhagen meetings in 2013 and the Paris meetings in 2015. And we've been looking at the way in which, at the international level, coordinated largely by the UN and various powerful states in the global north, have been trying to address the problem of global climate change, which is, of course, as everyone knows, you know, a global problem, but we don't at present have a global power with which to address it. And so we are trying to coordinate a collective effort on the part of various nation states. And that has, I think it's fair to say, pretty much entirely been a failure. And Joel and I are interested, therefore, in how those very same nation states may either change in terms of the exercise of power over time, or how they might alter the way in which they're organizing themselves to confront climate change, which at some point we anticipate being impossible to ignore on the part of elites and you know, the dominant states of the global north. Now, when that comes to pass, we expect, because of the very nature of the problem, the fact that it's unfolding at a global level but must be addressed at the national level, when that moment or moments occur, we expect that the most powerful states will assert a kind of power that now they only are able to exert inside their own territories. So we expect either the emergence of an attempt to, on the part of one state or perhaps a group of states, to coordinate the globe's response to climate change. And they may have to do so in a rather forceful, or even not just rather, a very forceful manner. And that's what I mean by the assertion of sovereign power, the assertion of a kind of power that we presently associate with a national government inside its own territory. But in this case, we would expect that sovereign power to expand, to sort of be arrogant enough to claim the need to save the globe in the interests of all of humanity. And we do already see those kinds of conversations, I think, emerging, and they have been emerging in the face of various expected problems like overpopulation and the ozone hole. We've had these kinds of conversations happening, and if you look back in time, we can see over and over again there's a pattern of a turn to a kind of planetary sovereign. But this is the first time that we've reached a point in the globe's ecology where we really expect that to be deemed necessary by the powers that be, in the interest of keeping those in power still in power.
I'm speaking with Jeff Mann about his co-authored book, Climate Leviathan, A Political Theory of Our Planetary Future, that's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So keeping with the possible path of Climate Leviathan, where would you place the United States in it, given that it has exercised a role, one might say an imperial role, in coordinating and dominating beyond the limits of its border around contemporary capitalism in many ways?
the United States in particular, of course, poses some really, really interesting questions. And I say interesting in that kind of dumb way that academics use it, which is to describe as interesting what is a calamity for other people. But it is true that the status of the U.S., especially at this moment, seems to be, as you say, both imperial and extraordinarily volatile. And in fact, I was having a conversation just the other day with Joel Wainwright, you know, my co-author, and he had just been at a bookstore talking about the book. And, you know, our fundamental argument that we see, you know, climate leviathan as the most likely trajectory of global climate politics in the near future was met with some skepticism by some people in the audience who, of course, point to Donald Trump and say, well, the U.S. is actually trying its best to be behemoth, to avoid any attempt to you know, implement a kind of planetary sovereignty, to climate deny till the cows come home, you know, to fight against precisely this process. And so far, it seems to have been very successful in doing so. So the status of the U.S. in this question is really interesting. Clearly, as you said, it has a lot of practice at imperialism, and it has proven, well, not as good as it often imagines. The U.S. state has proven, you know, to be pretty effective at imperialism. The question of how that might play out in a different realm, one in which, for example, let's say the U.S. Attempts to be one of the leading or perhaps the leading power in a global attempt to confront catastrophic climate change, which, as we know from scientific models, is potentially not, you know, something that is that far away, that our children almost certainly will be facing. The role of the U.S. in that we imagine to be to fit much more smoothly, let's say, into the general features of the model we're proposing. We both think that the kind of approach to climate change that has taken hold amongst those in power, let's say, in the U.S. right now, not clearly amongst the majority. Many people, of course, are concerned about climate change in the U.S. But the kind of attitudes to climate change that have taken hold of the minds of those in power, we don't expect that to be a long-term situation. There will be a point, I think, not in the not-too-distant future when, as I said, the problem will be impossible to ignore. And then we anticipate the U.S. arrogating to itself a great deal of imperial right to operate at the planetary level. Perhaps one of the more obvious ways in which that might play out, and certainly one of the riskier ones, is geoengineering, for which there's no framework, of course, for deciding what is appropriate manipulation of the climate at the planetary level.
And this is using technologies like shooting pollution up into the atmosphere to try and block the sun's rays and other things to cool the planet.
Exactly right. You know, seeding the ocean to increase its carbon sink capacity. Like you say, atmospheric sprays to reflect some of the sun's energy back into space. In fact, that latter one, so-called solar radiation management, is by far and away the most likely, we would say, geoengineering possibility in terms of technology. And the U.S. is the leading developer of such technologies. And there's a great deal of discussion, not only in the scientific community, about tests, you know, for these kinds of programs. This is to assert the need to make the sovereign decision to take control, you know, because something must be done, and to save the planet. And that will require a great deal, not just a great deal of arrogance, but a great deal of power to ensure control over that process. And we expect, if that is to come to pass, the U.S. to play a crucial role in that process, probably along with, you know, some other very, very important powers like China in particular.
Well, in imagining the different paths of our global future with climate change, you both examine paths that are capitalist and paths that are not. But staying with the capitalist for a bit more, how do you view the prospects of a green capitalism, a capitalism that is based on technologies that are ecologically less damaging than, say, some of the other possibilities on offer?
We don't have a great deal of faith in that route. Partly that is driven by the very simple and I think reasonably straightforward argument that that capitalism depends and always has on the continued expansion and growth of the system and the productivity as a whole. That requires more material throughput, whether it be solar panels or designer avocados that are organic, let's say. All of the production for production's sake is fundamental to the growth and therefore the stability of the capitalism as a mode of organizing economic life. That seems to us to be, at the most straightforward level, a dead end in the face of a climate problem that cannot handle more. But even if we could imagine some dream world in which that issue was overcome and our productivity was oriented entirely in non-material or green enhancing ways, we still nonetheless confront a problem where the coordination by the state of the overall capitalist productive apparatus, which has always been essential, I might add. It is the case that there is no capitalism without the state. There never has been, and as far as we know, there never will be. And insofar as that capitalist mode of production, mode of economic life, is dependent upon a state coordinating mechanism, then that state coordinating mechanism itself poses a problem to global coordination, precisely because the state is a territorial sovereign power, just like it always has been. And it poses real institutional and political barriers to a global mechanism that has the enforceable power to coordinate carbon emissions or carbon mitigation or perhaps adaptation at a global level. So the very existence of national sovereignty, upon which capitalism absolutely depends, poses a problem to any kind of global order. Now, the overcoming of that, I think, would look a lot like what I just described earlier in the form of climate leviathan. But that is a train that will run out of track eventually.
Well, let's talk about some of the other possible paths. Tell us about the scenario that you term climate behemoth.
In some ways, it is the least well-developed of the four. And in the book, and I think with good reason, partly because it's the most simplistic. It's also the one that we anticipate being in the medium to longer term, the most, let's say, temporary, precisely because it does, thus far, and it's manifestations, it is based largely on a sort of anti-planetary sovereign, nationalist, often reactionary form of politics that is likely to be completely unsustainable in the long run, given climate scenarios. But when we first wrote the paper upon which this book is based, which we did around 2010, we used as a sort of caricature of the climate behemoth the political power surrounding Sarah Palin and the sort of drill baby drill. There's no such thing as climate change. No one's going to tell the United States or any other country what to do. You know, this capitalist free market. We're going to mine and pump and burn coal till the cows come home kind of thing. That was what we had in mind with Behemoth. It was a refusal, a reaction to the climate leviathan mode that we understood to be emergent in existing global climate politics, like so those meetings in Copenhagen and Paris and stuff like that. And you did see our surrounding Palin at the time, and certainly having circled their wagons around Trump right now, you know, this kind of hyper-nationalist, often very racist, reactionary politics that sees anything that smacks of international power and therefore the reduction of American sovereignty as being bad categorically. And so climate behemoth is the climate variation of that. And right now it's in the White House, unfortunately. Of course, when we wrote the book, Trump was only just being elected, and we had been working on it since 2009. We never anticipated that such a ridiculous caricature of our behemoth would end up the president. But that's pretty close to what we were trying to describe.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the co-author of Climate Leviathan, a political theory of our planetary future that is published by Verso. The co-authors are Jeff Mann, my guest today, and Joel Wainwright. Jeff Mann is director of the Center for Global Political Economy at Simon Fraser University, and his other books include In the Long Run, We're All Dead, Keynesianism, Political Economy, and Revolution. So let's talk about the other possible paths in a future which is certainly going to be hotter and more chaotic than the present. And already, of course, climate change is with us. So for people who would like to see a change in the system, one sometimes hears the idea, partly a notion, partly a hope, that climate change is going to lead to a collapse of the capitalist system, and out of that, new worlds will be born. How much stock do you put in that way of seeing the future?
Like a lot of people, I probably have my days where that seems like a really workable hope. And I have, I would say, several more days where that seems really unlikely. But I do think that the challenges that climate change will pose for the ways we currently organize our lives, especially in the sort of extremely developed consumptive economies in which you and I live, I do think that climate change will pose such a significant challenge that we'll have no choice but to think hard about the kinds of alternatives that we want to arrange, because some alternative will be absolutely necessary. We can't keep going as things are. So I do think that there's hope. Sometimes I feel like I say that just because I don't want to have no hope. And sometimes I say that because I really do have hope. But I also would always want to flag the fact that those non-capitalist or alternative modes of organization that will be necessary and possible in a not too distant future are not all equally desirable, and some of them are downright terrifying and would make what we have look like a paradise. So I think the task for climate justice politics right now is to think about how to manage what will be a necessary transition or change.
Well, let's talk about the possibility of a way of organizing society outside of the framework of capitalism. Tell us about what you call climate Mao.
Sure. So climate Mao, Joel and I locate to the extent that we think it's possible. And actually, I do think it is more and more possible, I would say. We imagine that one of the ways in which human societies and the existing nation states might deal with climate change as it becomes more and more of an evident emergency for the majority of people would be to react against markets and the proliferation of the capitalist mode of organizing things, and to think hard about a revolutionary alternative like those that have come to pass in the past. And the one that we had in mind in particular, of course, is the Maoist revolution in China, and to think about in particular the power of China right now, its revolutionary history, and the political context in which it's situated, meaning an Asia that is particularly stressed by climate change and is likely to be even more so in the past, and to think about the conjuncture of those things, a revolutionary tradition of a very particular kind, let's say, in the Maoist tradition, hundreds of millions of people, potentially a huge proportion of whom will be incredibly stressed by the kinds of processes that climate change is going to unleash. And to look at an alternative mode of organizing in the face of that change would be to see a rejuvenation of the Maoist tradition. That's not to say right now that China is some Mao figure. China is, of course, a very complicated variation on capitalism, one might even argue right now. But it does have the political capacity and the political institutions, political economic institutions, that are built on a legacy, of a Maoist model. And in fact, the sort of president for lifing of she right now is arguably might facilitate this in an even better way. And so we are expecting, in particular, countries that perhaps already have a revolutionary tradition of mass organizing, especially amongst peasants, to react to climate change in a way very different than we would, say, in Canada and the United States, and to turn to a very heavy-handed variation of a kind of communist model that is extremely state-based, of course. And what's interesting is that when we to refer to this paper from 2000 that we wrote when we were starting thinking about this book, we presented this in lots of different places and spoke to students and folks at meetings all over the place. And what was interesting is that, especially since a large proportion of our audience were self-identified lefties, that very often what we called Climate Mao, which was less developed then, but very often what we called Climate Mao was by far and away the most attractive option to many people in the audience. It was really interesting. And partly that was driven by the sense of emergency. The Chinese state has already demonstrated several times around the Olympics, let's say, and stuff like that, that it has the capacity to get things done very quickly at a scale that is unimaginable in a functioning representative democracy. And so the very idea of a revolutionary state that has the capacity and power to respond to the emergency of climate change was very attractive to many people who saw it as really the only way out. Because as you and I will probably talk about in a few minutes, this more democratic model that we call Climate X definitely doesn't have that kind of responsiveness. And so it was a very interesting reaction, one that surprised us, to be honest with you. People were like, yeah, Climate Mao now, please.
Tell us about the fourth scenario that you and Joel Wainwright picture, which you call Climate X.
Right. So this is the one, again, these are ideal types. It's a heuristic, and we're very aware of the limits of the model. And so I just want to preface this with that reminder. But so this is the one we're hoping for, obviously. This is what we see as a non or an anti-planetary sovereign or even anti-sovereignty and anti-capitalist trajectory that would address not only the facts of climate change and hopefully to subdue it to some extent, but certainly to think hard about how we live in a climate-changed world, but to do so in a just way and a democratic way. And so, as I said, the way the boxes are structured in the model, this is the one that falls in the anti-sovereignty, anti-capitalist box. And insofar as that's the case, we really do imagine this being about a wide variety, not necessarily one movement, but a wide variety of movements struggling for democratic and just modes and means of dealing with a changing world in their communities where they live, coordinating what we would now think of as internationally or across communities in efforts to ensure as much as possible, equal access to a dignified life for people whose lives are going to be put at risk most likely very quickly in the face of climate change. Because as we know, the implications, the ecological and political implications of climate change are most immediate and most terrifying for those who are already the poorest and most marginalized in the planet. So we have to think about those of us in the privileged part of the world articulating with and in supporting not only the capacity of those communities to adapt, but to as much as possible about helping those communities and our own if it's possible to flourish, to actually, as you said earlier, to take advantage of the shift to produce a more just world. And so we call it X largely because we think that it's going to take a million different forms, and we're going to learn from a million different sources, and it's going to be very context specific. But one of the things it will not be is coordinated by a planetary sovereign. And one of the things it will not be is oriented around production for production's sake.
So anti-capitalist, as you say, yes. Not oriented around production for production's sake, but also anti-state or a different kind of vision of the state?
Yes, I think so, actually. And then I have to say, this is my own thought. I mean, all of this is, of course, my own thought, but I should say, some of the things that I'm now saying are things I haven't had a chance to talk over with Joel, whereas much of what I'm saying is, of course, a product of us thinking together. And one might even say that I've learned a lot more from him than he's learned from me. I would say that one of the things that I think our political situation right now suggests, both at an ecological level, but also in terms of the trajectory of current, say, quasi-fascisms or the emergent wannabe totalitarianisms that seem to be crystallizing in certain places, including Washington, those forces, I would suggest, should make us think very hard about, if not anti-state politics, certainly about a radical decentralization and localization of democratic decision making, if only because the kinds of impunity and devastating political actions that are unfolding right now at the national scale in several places would suggest to us that we need to keep power at the local level. We need to decentralize. And I think that climate change is a perfect example of how we have to confront this, precisely because of the virtually complete failure to do so at the national and international scale. I think that instead of continually hoping for the emergence of some Leviathan at the next conference of the parties meeting, we need to be thinking about, in fact, opposing the attempt to kind of keep business as usual. Somehow it'll be green and everything else will be the same. I think we need to fight that against that and to actually argue for the decentralization of the power to confront climate change. We'll do this at the local level if it's ever going to happen. And I think actually we already see this happening at cities all around the world who are saying, well, my state is a total failure. It's actually making climate change worse. So that at the local level, urban governments are trying to make these shifts happen. Those sorts of things are the things we need to really focus on, cultivate, nurture. I think the next meeting in whatever big city in whatever part of Western Europe shouldn't be our concern.
I'm speaking with Jeff Mann. He is the co-author of Climate Leviathan, A Political Theory of Our Planetary Future. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, in thinking about the different paths that our future could take, and thinking about the more desirable paths, which you're arguing for come from below, that are anti-capitalist, in thinking about how movements form, I wanted to ask you if you, since you write a lot about, and as someone grappling with political theory, about states of emergency and what happens in these moments of emergency, how does fear affect both the emergence of political movements and the kind of characteristics they take on?
Yeah, fascinating question. Obviously very important at this moment. It's, I suppose, something of an attempt to duck the question if I were to say something like, it can be many things. It can be a motivator. It can be a paralyzer, these kinds of things, even though I think, even though they're sort of platitudes, I think both those statements are sort of true. But I also think that at this moment, one of the sort of, I think, key organizing goals at a grand scale, of course, because it has to be just part of a whole series of other political efforts, is to do our best to confront fear explicitly. In other words, to not make it not a part of the conversation, to not suppress it or pretend it's not part of what's going on. I think one of the ways that we have the best chance of overcoming one of the places fear can take us, which is, of course, to vilify other people, particularly someone who might perhaps have to migrate into the United States or Canada, for example, to turn inward in this nationalist, anti-immigrant manner that we're seeing all over the place in various kinds of challenges. I think that one of the things we have to confront is to talk about fear, to make it a conversation piece that we can admit to, that we can confront, and that we can, as much as possible, subdue by looking it straight in the face and asking ourselves what it's making us do and what we might otherwise wish to be doing. So instead of allowing fear to be the organizer, it's more like we have to organize in the face of fear, not saying that we're brave and there's nothing to fear and this kind of stuff, this sort of Churchillian approaches to you know, something like the Second World War, but more like we are in trouble. Let's think for a moment about the kinds of ways that we need to react to face up to this problem, while at the same time comforting ourselves in the fact that we are afraid, and that so are the people who are moving here, so are the other nations in the world. We have to make it as explicit as possible. I think this is true, actually, not just of fear, but of a sort of tragic sensibility that seems to me to be saturating modern life, where there is a feeling that we live in something like end times. Now, I really hope, and I actually, on the good days, honestly believe that's not true. But I do think that if we allow that to grow even bigger and to dominate more and more our understanding of the future, and especially in the way that we raise our children and understand the long-term trajectories of our lives and the institutions that depend on them, I think that would be a disaster. So my goal right now actually is to talk precisely about these things, to think about what it means to live in fear, what it means to understand one's moment in history as a tragedy, because we still need to answer those everyday questions of love and security and dignity and getting by and looking each other in the face and caring. And that doesn't go away in a moment that is saturated by fear and that tragic sensibility. I apologize for the vagueness of these feelings, but you've hit a nerve for sure.
Not at all. I mean, that fatalism definitely infuses a lot of the writings on the left. And you note in the book that in many of the writings on climate, the conclusion, and using this a modified version of this term that's acceptable with the FCC, it's we're effed. And yet, of course, there's all sorts of implications of fatalism for thinking about different possible paths, and that there's not just one path. And I think that's connected to another point you make in the book, which is that it's in thinking about the future on a hotter planet, it's easy to lapse into a kind of environmental determinism that what happens ecologically is going to shape in a very narrow way what happens politically. But you are arguing that, in fact, is not necessarily the case.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You've said it exactly as I would like to have said it, and probably much more articulately.
And then connected to that, let me ask you about how we should try to infuse a kind of politics into something which often is seen as being within the arena of science. We look to scientists to tell us whether we've passed a tipping point, the point of no return. What are the limits of thinking about this issue only through a scientific lens? Obviously, that also needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Certainly, science is absolutely essential to any attempt to think about how we might confront climate change. It's certainly, to state the obvious, it's been essential to understand the very problem itself. And in fact, precisely because of its sort of slow staccato of what seemed like increasingly rapid crises, but previously were perhaps harder to see, science has been essential to even identifying it as something that we need to think about. So the role of science has been and will continue to be essential. That said, as we say in the book, and as many people have all said in lots of other books, science is inescapably social. The problems to which it turns, the questions it imagines itself able to answer, and the power that's associated with the knowledge and in whose hands that knowledge is held, are always a direct product of the political, economic, and social organization of the communities in which that knowledge emerges and circulates. And so science is always an attempt, I think, to understand the world in something like an objective fashion, but it can never be objective beyond that moment, in the sense that that knowledge held by people is always, as everyone knows, I suppose, power. To know is to have power to some extent. And if that's the case, then as soon as we do have this knowledge, how it's mobilized, who it's used by, and the kinds of questions to which it's turned are, of course, the crucial political questions that the rest of us can have a lot of say in, even if we're not scientists. So all of this to say that science is crucial, but it can't be the answer. It can be part of our response, but it can't be the answer. And in fact, I think our current situation would be proof that it can't be the answer. Because clearly, just the increasing pile of knowledge that we are effed, as you say, is not motivating or producing the kind of response we need. So the answers are not in science, though science, of course, must be part of the answer.
Well, speaking about knowledge, let me end by asking you a question about theory. And I think you would agree that this is not simply an academic question. So the subtitle of your book, Climate Leviathan, is a political theory of our planetary future. And you argue that the body of, or most of the body of existing political theory is just not up to the task of imagining the world in a climate-changed future. And partly that's because political theory assumes that societies will stay stable, but the future looks like it's going to be unstable. Why do you think it is important that we grapple with theory here, that we are able to seize on the right kind of analysis as a tool for social movements and social change?
So that's a super interesting question. Clearly, Joel and I struggle, like many, many, many other people, to think about the articulation between, you know, the kind of work we do in the academy, which is often, as you know, and this book falls victim to this, certainly at many points, which is, you know, aimed to a very kind of specialized audience with a particular kind of training and comfort level with a certain, you know, not just a certain discourse, but even a certain jargon and a whole history of, you know, in this case, political thought, but it could be any other kind of thought. If I was an engineer, it's not like it would be that much clearer to the vast majority of people. So we struggle with how to, you know, make sense of that. And in fact, struggle with how to not only make sense of that, but how to feel good about that in a world that sometimes seems like we are fiddling while Rome burns, because here we are doing political theory while wildfires eat up California, for example. It's a constant worry, and perhaps it's part of what drives our research to these questions that we think of as being important socially, so we can connect them. But I would also say, and this is going to sound defensive because here I've co-written a book on political theory, that even people who think of themselves as anti-theoretical or really empirically focused or empiricist even, even people who imagine that their confrontation with the world on a daily basis in an attempt to make sense of it, to change it, to even merely to just adapt to it, those people are all relying absolutely irreducibly on extremely complicated theories of how the world works, whether they know it or not. And I know that sounds kind of arrogant to say, but it's always true that it's, or at least I would say it's always true that our confrontation with the world and our attempts to make sense of it are always filtered by the categories we've learned to put things in and to make sense of movement and change or the lack thereof. And insofar as those categories map our world for us, every moment we're in facing it, every moment we're in the middle of it, every moment we're looking at it, those categories are the elements that make up a theory of the world. They are the reason you expect certain things to happen when you do certain things, or not to happen when you don't do certain things. And so that means that if that's true, that theory always mediates everything we do in the world, then with something as important as climate change or the political organization of our lives, we should be really effing careful to be as clear and as critical in that thinking of our theory as we can, to put it right on the table, to be explicit about it, to talk about the categories we're using, what's in them, what's out of them, have they changed, have they not. We have to really burn in on those with our eyes and our hands and our brains to understand our experience of the world and where it might take us. So Joel and I think, would defend the work of theory as being absolutely essential, if of course never enough on its own, but absolutely essential to every single political endeavor. And so here we have taken what, you know, is a rather academic first stab at this, but we're hoping to connect with people who aren't just academics, who are just as concerned about the categories and processes through which we try to make sense of our world and how we might use those or change them so that we can have a better world, or at least one that persists, you know, in which our children can live safe, dignified, and joyful lives.
Jeff Mann, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a real honor to get to talk to you.
I've been speaking with the director of the Center for Global Political Economy at Simon Fraser University, co-author of Climate Leviathan, a political theory of our planetary future. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. Joel Wainwright is the other author. And Jeff Mann's other books include In the Long Run, We're All Dead. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Thank you.